Now on Food FM, you're listening to Bread and Butter with Caroline Kenyon. Caroline and her guests make sense of the world through food, from politics to farming, making and cooking.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Bread and Butter. I'm Caroline Kenyon, and it's my pleasure that I'm able to invite onto the show all sorts of fascinating people. It can't really have escaped your attention that January was Veganuary, growing bigger and bigger, not just in the UK, but around the world every year. And it's an enormous pleasure to have on the programme today Sam Calvert, who's Head of Communications at the Vegan Society. Welcome to you, Sam.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
Wonderful. Well, I know that you have a really interesting food journey story to share with us yourself, actually, Sam. So tell us a little bit about yourself. I think I gather you actually grew up in Zambia for part of your childhood. Tell us about that and what it was like as a sort of a food influence.
Yes, I lived in Zambia as a child. My father worked there on the Copper Belt. I lived in Zambia as a child between the ages of 6 and 11. And I think it probably did have an impact on who I am in dietary terms today. I certainly remember one of the things that was always happening socially was that you would have things like pig on a spit. And I always remember as a child feeling really upset because you could see the animal, you could see the full shape of the animal. And it just seemed incredibly sad, and it was something I would never eat at events. I also remember that at one point we often had food shortages. Politically, borders were closed with other countries where food had traditionally travelled to Zambia, and there were a lot of food shortages around. And I remember once going to a slaughterhouse where we were collecting chickens, dead chickens, to be used at an event. My father was very involved with amateur football, and they had a fundraising event, and there was a lot of catering going on, and I went with him to collect these. And I remember it wasn't particularly enclosed, and you could see all the chickens hanging upside down by their legs, going towards, you know, what I now know would have been the stunning bath, you know, to be stunned before they were slaughtered, and then you could see them come out the other side with their necks slit. And I remember that being kind of quite a very memorable thing. I guess I would probably have been 8 or 9, perhaps. You know, similarly, I can remember, you know, people would have a few hens in the garden, and they would wring their necks. That was how they would kill them. Things like that. I think it was a bit more raw and a bit more real than perhaps going to a supermarket and things. There were occasions, not frequent occasions, but occasions where I felt kind of up close and personal with the suffering of animals. I certainly know that, left to my own devices, by the age of 8, I think I would have been vegetarian. I certainly didn't want to eat meat by that stage. It actually took me, in the end, I think, until I was about 17 to become vegetarian. But I think once I'd met people who were vegetarians and were, you know, they were alive still. You often get told, you were told in those days, that you might not survive if you were vegetarian, or that you would be unwell, you'd have nutritional deficiencies. Once I'd met people who were happy and healthy as a vegetarian, there was no stopping me, really, and it's something I've never looked back on.
That's so fascinating, Sam. I mean, what a formative experience, and I can just imagine how traumatic it was to see those scenes as a small child. I mean, did you express those feelings to your parents?
I think I probably just accepted it in some ways. I mean, it was certainly upsetting, and they certainly knew that. I mean, they knew the pig on the spit example. They knew that I was upset by animals like that, and they would often have to take me away from those sorts of events and say, "Oh, you know, Samantha's very upset by this. We're going home now." But I think there was much more of an acceptance that was life. I mean, I certainly remember as a child, when I was younger, I would sort of say, "So this is, you know, pork. Where does pork come from? Is that an animal?" And you'd often be told, no, it's not. Just eat it. It's good for you. So I think there wasn't really the level of engagement you get today, where perhaps parents would be much more willing to enter into a discussion and change diets and so on. And I think, in fairness to my parents, we were living in a society that had food shortages, and I was what was seen as a picky child, a child that was fussy about what they would eat. I was quite slim. I can understand that you wouldn't want in that situation to have your child refusing whole categories of food like all meat, because it would have been difficult. So I can understand why and how it happens. But certainly I think it had an influence, and it is one of the things that I think made me perhaps think more about vegetarianism. Though I'm kind of convinced that some of us are just built this way. I just feel as though I've always meant to be vegetarian, always meant to be now vegan. That it's part of who I am. I feel like I was probably born this way.
No, I really understand that, Sam. And I think, you know, I think what you say about it was, you know, sort of more upfront and real. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of dishonesty about the way that meat is purveyed in our kind of society, that it's, you know, that the reality of the production is sort of hidden away, and it's all presented in a very sanitized fashion in shops or supermarkets. You know, you saw something that was more truthful, and it allowed you to make a decision based on a truthful depiction of what it really is.
Yes, and I think most children, you know, children are often encouraged to be kind to animals, you know, to be nice to companion animal dogs and cats, and to behave nicely around animals and appropriately. And we've read, you know, stories where animals are given human characteristics. So we read those stories as children, and they're read to us as children. So I think we're brought up to feel that empathy with animals. However, with another category of animals, we're not meant to feel that empathy. So this group here are labelled pets or companion animals, and this group here are labelled food. And you're not meant to feel the same level of empathy for the food animals, because that's their purpose. Or even you're told they wouldn't exist if we didn't eat them. They only exist because we eat them. So the only way they're going to have a life is because you eat them. And of course, that really is disingenuous, because we breed animals, and if people didn't eat them, they simply wouldn't be bred, which isn't quite the same thing as being slaughtered.
No, that's very well put. So let's go back to little Sam growing up. So you were in Zambia until you were 11. Then you came to the UK.
Yes, that's right.
What kind of impact did British food, British school food, make on you?
I mean, I suppose I had lived in England until I was 6 years of age, and I had come back at a couple of points, you know, on holiday, stayed with family and in the UK. So I think very much our culture in Zambia was to eat as much as you were able to get it, the food you would have been eating in England. So I don't think it was greatly different. But I guess I was still uncomfortable about the idea of eating animals. That was certainly a key factor. As I said, from about the age of eight, I was someone who wouldn't have chosen to eat meat. I'd understood enough then that these products were made from animals that had to be killed for me, and I didn't want to be part of that. But I think I was persuaded into this is the way it is, and there isn't really an alternative, and it's not nutritionally sound for you to eat any differently. By the time I reached a secondary school, well, probably more likely sixth form, there was someone who was vegetarian in my school, in my year at sixth form, and I realised that this was, you know, perfectly possible. Someone else I knew became vegetarian around that time, one of my friends, and I just decided this was something that I wanted to do. It was doable. These people were perfectly healthy, and I could do that too. So I think that was the point where I was able to determine my own future in that way and make a change. And I was vegetarian then for 10 years. It took me a full 10 years before I became fully vegan. So I can empathise with people who follow, you know, a journey that takes some time. I think at that period, most people would have been vegetarian for a number of years before becoming vegan. Nowadays, it's obviously much more common that people become vegan overnight, but that was almost unknown, I would have said then.
Yes, that's certainly my observation. My son is vegan, and for him, it was a journey. I am not, but I have certainly massively reduced, well, meat and fish consumption and all animal products as a result. I think I am on a journey, but it's slow. It's slow, but I, you know, I do reflect upon it, well, every day really. And I think many of my friends are doing so. And I'm really interested when you say that you were 17 and at school, and there was, you know, somebody in your class who was a vegetarian. And I just remember, I mean, now it's just so common. I mean, I'm guessing that I'm older than you, and I find that all my friends have either got children who are vegan, or somebody who's, you know, their son's girlfriend is vegan, or their sister, and it's just so common that everybody is kind of networked into this new way of understanding how we should eat. It's taken that time, hasn't it, to become so much more everyday.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I think we have seen that change. It feels as though it's happened overnight, I think, to a lot of people, but it hasn't. You know, there have been people working away at this for generations. After I became vegetarian at 17, I think when I was 18, I spent some of my birthday money on joining the Vegetarian Society. And I became a member at 18 because I really wanted to be part of a movement, a group of people who wanted this thing to grow and wanted to share this thing with other people, and I wanted to support that work. Some years later, I was actually, you know, fortunate enough to be employed to work at the Vegetarian Society. So I spent some years working there as initially in campaigning, and then sort of more generally communications. And I think that, you know, being you become aware of the history of the movement. The Vegetarian Society in England was founded in 1847, for example. The Vegan Society that I work for now was founded in 1944, and it was a group of people who were members of the Vegetarian Society that founded the Vegan Society. So we have these quite strong links. So these things go back. People often think that this whole movement must have started in the 1960s with a kind of with that kind of love and peace sort of movement, that the countercultural movement that was going on then, but actually it goes back much further, and there have been people doing exactly the work that I do now, generations ago. I remember reading one of the journals, one of the Vegetarian Society's journals in their library from 1912, where they talked about a vegetarian day. So they were holding awareness days in 1912. There's a very long history of doing exactly the same work that we've been doing.
That's so wonderful to hear. I love that. So tell me, I am aware of the kind of the sort of political and also, you know, religious connections with vegetarianism. My mother's aunt and uncle were pre-war socialists, and they were vegetarian. It was sort of, you know, very, you call it fashionable, but it was part of the group with which they socialized and politicized with. And I know that your studies, Sam, have taken you into the area of exploring the links with Christianity. So tell us a little about that, and how you came to find it was a sort of a rich vein to mine.
Working for the Vegetarian Society, when I started to work there, I think I'd just become vegan, and I was fortunate to be in an environment where there were other people working there who were vegan, and they ran a cookery school, so there were people who were specialists on vegetarian cookery who could help me with vegan recipes. So I think I was very fortunate at that point in history when it was more difficult to be vegan, and to be surrounded by other people that could support that journey for me as a new vegan. But I was also aware that we had loads of these bound volumes in what was then a corridor, and I remember asking, what are those? And they were the bound journals of the Vegetarian Society dating back to 1847. And I was told, the society was founded by a Christian group in the Salford area of Manchester. And and I thought that was really interesting. My first degree had been in religious studies, and I thought it would be interesting to find out more about them. That really set me on a journey of looking at that group of people. They were called the Bible Christian Church, and the Salford Bible Christian Church grew out of another group, the Swedenborgian Jerusalem New Church, and they were a vegetarian group. They were a very sort of mystically inspired group, but they very much were Christians. They were pacifists. They were vegetarian. They were teetotal. So not just temperate, as in not drinking spirits, but actually completely teetotal. So there was this whole sort of package of beliefs that went with them. When I decided I wanted to do an MA, I chose as my sort of dissertation to look at the Bible Christians and their influence on the vegetarian movement. And later my PhD grew out of that into a more generally looking at the relationship between Christianity and vegetarianism in the UK. So it kind of expanded really from that one group to other groups that have had this similar interest in both Christianity and the vegetarian diet.
That's utterly fascinating. And tell me, I mean, because vegetarianism, indeed veganism, has been historically intertwined with faith in India for centuries. Mm. Has that had an influence on Christian thinking here?
I mean, certainly that's where, when you talk about the links between religion and vegetarian diet, that's naturally where you would think of it in terms of the religions that come from the East. And, you know, I think particularly religions that are linked to reincarnation, it's quite common that if you think there's a possibility that you might be reincarnated as a food animal, then you're much more likely to think differently about food animals. So that there is that connection as well. And I think that's where we traditionally find this link between diet and religion, and not particularly in Christianity, because of course, you know, famously there's, you know, Peter's dream where we're told that, you know, Christians, it's not forbidden that they can now eat all animals, unlike within the Jewish faith. So that's how we think about Christianity. But there have been exceptions to that rule, and I think that's they've come from a particular sort of route, and one of those is this sort of often there's a revelations that have been given to a founder of the group, or they take a different interpretation of Christianity, so they don't necessarily follow the Bible, but might have reinterpreted scriptures. So there's usually something heterodox about their teachings in some way that allows for vegetarianism within it. But there are mainstream groups as well that have also accepted vegetarianism. I'm thinking, you know, that there are groups within the mainstream denominations like Anglicanism and Catholicism of people who are concerned about animal welfare, or, you know, vegetarian groups. The Quakers, for example, about a third of Quakers would be vegetarian. That's quite, you know, quite common. The Seventh-day Adventists, again, their founder, Ellen G. White, was very committed to vegetarianism and a lot of her teachings. So it's quite an important element within Seventh-day Adventism, and you will often find that, certainly institutionally, you know, if you go to a Seventh-day Adventist college, for example, or a hospital, they would always have a vegetarian diet available, and nowadays often vegan food as well. So there are some more mainstream examples, but a lot of the Christian vegetarian groups were quite small groups, and were often interpreting scripture differently. The groups like the Order of the Golden Age, the Order of the Cross, the Order of the Danielites. There are quite a number of these groups that had vegetarian teachings.
That is so interesting. Tell me a little more about your role now at the Vegan Society, Sam. And how long have you been in that particular role?
About 4.5 years in this role as head of communications.
Yes, and I mean, in that 4 years, I mean, the perception of veganism has, I would say, changed almost beyond recognition from my external perspective.
Yes, I think I suppose I previously worked for the society in a freelance role from about 2012 to 2014, it was during that time that I really saw something happening that was changing. Historically, if veganism was mentioned at all in the mainstream media, it was usually in a negative context. And I say that because there has been academic research as well looking at that very point, so examining all references to veganism and, you know, giving them a sentiment of whether they were positive or negative. And it certainly was the case that overwhelmingly references to veganism would be negative. For example, it might be a case of a baby that's died because the parents gave it this inappropriate vegan diet, those sorts of things. Maybe talking about militancy within veganism. Those stories are where it would have been mentioned. Around about 2012, something seemed to happen in the zeitgeist that was coming over from the USA. We had high-profile sort of A-list celebrities who people who are seen as, you know, the attractive people, the glamorous people, the people with lots of money, people who could afford their own personal chefs. And these people were choosing to be vegan. And you started to see stories filtering into the UK media as well, talking about figures like Jay-Z and Beyonce becoming vegan, or at least following a vegan diet. They kind of moved in and out of it. But those sorts of stories, and they weren't being produced in a negative way. It was more more factual, and nothing negative was being said about this diet. There was also a book by Mark Bittman, V Before Six, which was advocating, again an American author, advocating a vegan diet and vegan recipe book, where you, during the day you would be vegan, and then the diet wasn't vegan in the evening. So it was a predominantly plant-based diet, not vegan in the sense that veganism is much more of a complete commitment, but this idea of part-time veganism, if we can use that term, that was being reported as well. And I think we were starting to see a more positive portrayal in the media of veganism, and that's when it starts to be permitted. Society almost has to change its mind about it before people feel that this is something they can explore. And you've then started to see people sharing more recipes on social media, dishes that looked really beautiful. It became much more aspirational. And I think that's when we started to see this change. You could feel that there was something happening where veganism had moved from its traditional position of being extreme. I remember as a vegetarian thinking that vegans were extreme, that it was taking vegetarianism to an extent that was unnecessary, because I didn't understand why people were vegan at that point. I hadn't understood the welfare and animal rights issues behind it, and that was how veganism was generally portrayed, as something a bit extreme, and something changed at that point. You could see that it was now being portrayed as perhaps something that was more positive. Prior to that, you know, there were the characters, I think things like Coronation Street was a good example. There was a character, I think it was the nephew of Emily Nugent, who was obviously based on the figure of Swampy, who was known in the media in terms of tree saving trees and those sorts of campaigns. And she had this nephew come to live with her, who was the very caricature of everything that veganism was held out to be. You know, somebody who was very much, you know, good-hearted and an eco-warrior, but had this very strange diet. It was an alternative lifestyle, a countercultural image. That was typical of how vegans would always have been portrayed. Suddenly you've got these A-listers who are now being portrayed as vegans. And there was around about 2013, maybe, there was a programme, the BBC did a programme, Radio 4 did a programme called The New Vegans. And that was the first time I'd really heard that expression used. And what they were looking at was the fact that there was this growth of this new group of vegans who weren't performing to that type. There were different sorts of vegans, and they kind of explored that relationship. And that was where I thought there's something changing here. And it was probably the first time, I think, or almost the first time that that sort of programme had been, the site had been approached about that sort of programme.
That's such a great account, Sam. It's all those strands coming together, as you say, and one might say celebrity influencers, a popular soap opera, so many different forces coming together and normalising something which before had been seen as kind of niche and slightly, as you say, negative, maybe a bit threatening. I mean, I do remember when it's 6 years since my son became vegan, and he'd done the journey through vegetarianism mm-hmm. to veganism. And my mother-in-law, who was still alive then, was the most incredible cook. And she was absolutely fine when her grandson was vegetarian. But when he became vegan, she was really nervous about cooking for him. Mm-hmm. I remember I felt really apprehensive. Whereas now, I mean, I said probably 6 days of the week I am vegan, and then I might... Mm-hmm. fall off the wagon, you know, one day a week. But because I have all the ingredients in the house, I know that my balsamic vinegar is vegan, I know my sugar is vegan, it's just not an issue anymore. Whereas before, I think I just had this kind of fog of fear in my head that I was going to kind of get it wrong, or I couldn't create something nice. But once you've gone through that barrier and you understand it, there's nothing frightening about it at all. But I think a lot of people do perceive it as a bit intimidating.
Yes. And I think that there was, you know, there was definitely a period, I think, where if you were vegan, you were sort of seen as the kind of the dinner guest from hell. You know, what do I feed these people? What do they eat? What's left to eat? That's long gone, I think, that feeling. I mean, I can certainly recall a time thinking that if I was able to go into a coffee shop and order a cup of tea or coffee with soya milk, that would be a huge achievement, and my life would be so much easier if that were possible, rather than carrying around a plastic, you know, cup of soya milk in a plastic bag that would probably leak into the bag and smell dreadful forever. And, you know, it seems incredible now to when every chain would, and most independent coffee shops might offer several different sorts of plant milks. But that doesn't seem, although it probably was a few decades ago, it doesn't seem that long ago, when that was a hopeless dream that you could go somewhere and say, can I have that with soya milk? And now I could probably go into a coffee chain and choose from three different plant milks. And more to the point, the person behind me ordering the plant milk might not even be vegan. They might just be somebody who says, you know, I really quite like oat milk with my coffee. They're making a positive choice, because actually, why choose from one or two types of milk, you know, full fat or semi-skimmed or skimmed, when you can choose from all these different milks that have much, you know, add flavour to your drink. They're actually a new experience. It seems to me that non-vegans are perhaps limiting themselves rather than vegans limiting themselves, because we have so much more choice of plant milks.
No, I would agree with you there. I'm a great oat milk aficionado, especially British oat milk. So I think it's good to have ones that haven't come
a good choice for the environment.
Which leads to exactly. Now, that was something I wanted to ask you, Sam. So in your role, are you able to unravel what the impulse is behind more and more people embracing in veganism? Is it the morality argument? Is it climate emergency? Do you know where people are coming from?
I think it's still fairly equally split between people who are concerned about animal rights or animal welfare issues, people who are concerned about environmental issues, particularly amongst the younger age groups. I mean, veganism is a very young movement, so most the typical vegan will have become vegan within the last 4 years. They will be more likely to be female, much more likely to be female, quite likely to be under 35. Likely to be under 25 even, so it's a very youthful movement, and the younger vegans are more likely to have been motivated by environmental concerns, I think, although I wouldn't say that that's necessarily outstripping the concerns for animal rights or animal welfare, but certainly younger people, I think, are more aware of these issues, and it's more relevant to them as well. Of course, they're going to sadly feel the brunt of any decisions that we do or don't make now, so it's understandable why they're much more committed to these issues. But I think it's still split, you know, fairly evenly. The other area, of course, is human health. There are lots of people that become vegan because they consider that it will be beneficial to their health. Perhaps they have family members who've suffered particular illnesses that they feel that a vegan diet will help them to avoid. And you know, I think that's quite a strong strand as well.
No, I understand that. I spent 2020 in London caring for my mother, who was 90 and very fragile. And my community shrank from, you know, the kind of big world that we inhabit. Everybody's community shrank. But I was away from my husband for a year. My community was my mother, my brother, and myself. And I did all the cooking, which was a pleasure and a relaxation in a time of enormous stress and anxiety. And we certainly had a vegetarian diet, and my mother had had digestive issues for, I'd say, 30 years. And I think that's one of my proudest things, is that they went.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
She was really, she was well, and I felt really happy that I could do that for her. So that's quite a sort of quite a silver lining in what seemed like a very big cloud at the time. But I know this, you know, there's so much positive to think about, but, you know, we are chatting at a time of great political turmoil, and, you know, it's hard not to be thinking with part of one's mind all the time about what's happening in Ukraine. Now, Ukraine is, you know, one of the great food producers of the world, the grain basket of Europe. It produces 10% of the world's wheat. Is that something that you're realizing is going to impact the world of veganism? Do you think that maybe there'll be less animal feed in the world, and therefore the price of meat is going to go up? Might it mean that more people embrace veganism from an economic point of view? I mean, is this something you've been mulling over, and how it might impact your world?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly it certainly comes into play to some extent. I think vegans have always been people who were quite aware of not just where meat comes from, but where their food comes from as well. So I think you're more likely to come across vegans who are concerned about, as you said yourself, about whether the protein is British grown, whether their veg is British grown, often those are issues that I think vegans have often thought about, because they do tend to be people who reflect on their ethical decisions generally. So there are quite a number of vegans who wouldn't, for example, consider palm oil or palm fats to be acceptable. They're aware of the impact that it has on animal welfare. So even though the product itself isn't necessarily not suitable for vegans, they would avoid it. So I think there are people who are making, you know, those sorts of ethical decisions all the time, and it is something that you know, that we reflect on. In terms of grain supply, then yes, certainly most of the, you know, one of the things you often hear is about, you know, the damage that, you know, soya does, and that part of that problem is that vegans eat so much soya, which of course doesn't acknowledge the fact that most soya is grown to feed cattle. Not necessarily in the UK, but worldwide, soya is generally being grown to feed cattle. And I think, you know, we do produce an awful lot of food to feed to animals so that we can subsequently kill those animals in order to eat them. And it would have been much more productive to have eaten plant-based in the first place. You know, we're cycling our food through other animals. And that whole thing, once you start thinking about that process, it doesn't really make very much sense. And I think anyone who ponders it long enough would wonder why we do it. Why don't we just eat the food that the animals are eating instead of this awful system where we breed and then destroy animals whilst feeding them other food that also takes up land and water, which is quite a precious resource, in order to feed the animals. How much that's going to, this particular crisis is going to impact on our food, I don't, and animal farming, I don't know. Certainly in the UK, it probably isn't, you know, it's probably not as much of an issue as it would be in some countries, in terms of the amount of food that we're feeding to animals rather than grazing, for example. There's a certain amount of grazing going on in the UK that would probably make that not necessarily a crisis here.
Very, very fascinating. Sam, I think sadly we've come to the end of our allotted time, but it's been so interesting to talk to you. I would love to talk to you for longer. Thank you so much for sharing your journey and your thoughts with us. And I would love to talk to you again in a little while and to see where this exciting vegan, shall I use the word, journey explosion is taking so many people.
It's been my pleasure. It's been good to talk to you today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bread and Butter with Caroline Kenyon.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.